Young Sam was already reading by himself these days, which was a great relief. Fortunately, the works of Miss Felicity Beadle did not consist solely of exciting references to Pooh in all its manifestations, but her output of small volumes for young children was both regular and highly popular, at least among the children. This was because she had researched her audience with care, and young Sam had laughed his way through The Wee Wee Men, The War with the Snot Goblins, and Geoffrey and the Land of Pooh. For boys of a certain age, they hit the squashy spot. At the moment he was giggling and choking his way through The Boy Who Didn't Know How to Pick His Own Scabs, an absolute hoot for a boy just turned 6. Sybil pointed out that the books were building young Sam's vocabulary, and not just about lavatorial matters, and it was indeed true that he was beginning, with encouragement, to read books in which nobody had a bowel movement at all, which, when you came to think about it, was a mystery all by itself. Vimes carried his son to bed after 10 minutes of enjoyable listening, and had managed to shave and get into the feared evening clothes a few minutes before his wife knocked on the door. Separate dressing rooms and bathrooms, Vimes thought. If you had the money, there was no better way to keep a happy marriage happy. And, in order to keep a happy marriage happy, he allowed Sybil to bustle in, wearing, in fact, a bustle. Sybil had explained to Vimes that in the country one dresses at least a decade earlier than in the city, hence the bustle, and for Vimes a pair of breeches. The ancient ones with trap doors front and rear, and a slightly distressing smell all over. To adjust his shirt, tweak his collar, and make him fit for company. And then she said, "I understand you gave the blacksmith a short lesson in unarmed combat, my dear." The pause hung in the air like a silken noose. Vimes managed, "There's something wrong here, I know it."
"I think so too," said Sybil.
"You do?"
"Yes, Sam, but this is not the time. We have guests arriving at any minute. If you could refrain from throwing any of them over your shoulder in between courses, I would be grateful."
This was a terrific scolding by Sybil's normally placid standards. Vimes did what any prudent husband would do, which was dynamically nothing. Suddenly, all downstairs was full of voices and the noise of carriages crunching over the gravel. Sybil trimmed her sails and headed down to be the gracious hostess. Despite what his wife liked to imply, Vimes was rather good at dinners, having sat through innumerable civic affairs in Ankh-Morpork. The trick was to let the other diners do the talking while agreeing with them occasionally, giving himself time to think about other things. Sybil had made certain that this evening's dinner was a light occasion. The guests were mostly people of a certain class, who lived in the country but were not, as it were, of it. Retired warriors, a priest of Om, Miss Pickings, a spinster, together with her companion, a strict-looking lady with short hair and a man's shirt and pocket watch, and, yes, Miss Felicity Beadle. Vimes thought he had put his foot in it when he said, "Oh, yeah, the Pooh lady," but she burst out laughing and shook his hand, saying, "Don't worry, Your Grace, I wash mine thoroughly after writing." And it was a big laugh. She was a small woman, with a strange aspect that you see in some people that causes them to appear to be subtly vibrating even when standing perfectly still. You felt that if some interior restraint suddenly broke, the pent-up energy released would catapult her through the nearest window. Miss Beadle prodded him in the stomach. "And you are the famous Commander Vimes. Come to rest us all, have you?" Of course, you got this all the time if you didn't stop Sybil accepting the invitation to yet another posh society do. But while Miss Beadle laughed, silence fell on the other guests like a cast-iron safe. They were scowling at Miss Beadle, and Miss Beadle was staring intently at Vimes, and Vimes knew that expression. It was the expression of somebody with a story to tell. Certainly, this was no time to broach the subject, and so Vimes filed it under interesting. Whatever Vimes' misgivings, Ramkin Hall did a damn good dinner, and this was the important thing, the dictates of popular social intercourse decreed that Sybil had to allow a menu full of things that would not be permitted at home if Vimes had asked for them. It's one thing to act as arbiter of your own husband's tastes, but it is frowned on to do the same to your guests. Across the table from him, a retired military man was being assured by his wife that he did not, contrary to what he himself believed, like potted shrimps. In vain the man protested weakly that he thought he did like potted shrimps, to get the gentle response, "You may like potted shrimps, Charles, but they do not like you." Vimes felt for the man, who seemed puzzled at having developed enemies among the lower crustacea. "Well, does lobster like me, dear?" he said, in a voice that did not express much hope. "No, dear, it does not get on with you at all. Remember what happened at the Parsley's whist evening." The man looked at the groaning sideboard and tried, "Do you think the scallops could get on with me for 5 minutes or so?" "Good heavens, no, Charles."
He cast a glance at the sideboard again.
"I expect the green salad is my bosom friend, though, isn't it?"
"Absolutely, dear."
"Yes, I thought so."
The man looked across at Vimes and gave him a hopeless grin, followed by,
"I'm given to believe that you're a policeman, Your Grace, is that right?"
Vimes took proper stock of him for the first time. A whiskery old warrior now out to grass, and that was probably all his wife was going to let him eat without an argument. He had burn scars on his face and hands, and the accent of Pseudopolis. Easy.
"You were with the Light Dragons, weren't you, sir?"
The old man looked pleased.
"Well done, that man. Not many people remember us. Alas, I'm the only one left. Colonel Charles Augustus Makepeace. Strange name for a military man, or perhaps not, I don't know." He sniffed. "We're just a scorched page in the history of warfare. I dare say you haven't read my memoirs, 24 years without eyebrows, no? Well, you're not alone in that, I have to say. Met your missus in those days. She told us it would be totally impossible to breed dragons stable enough for use in warfare. She was right for no mistake. Of course, we went on trying, because that's the military way."
"Do you mean pile dreadful failure on top of failure?" said Vimes. The colonel laughed.
"Well, it works sometimes. I still keep a few dragons, though. Wouldn't be without them. A day without a singe is a day without sunshine. They're a great saving in matches, and of course they keep undesirables away, too."
Vimes reacted like an angler who, after some time dozing by the water's edge, felt that the fish were rising.
"Oh, you don't get many of them round here, surely?" "You think so? You don't know the half of it, young man. I can tell you a few stories."
He stopped talking abruptly, and Vimes's experience of husbandry told him that the man had just been kicked under the table by his wife, who did not look happy, and to judge by the lines on her face, probably never had. She leaned past her husband, who was now accepting another brandy from the waiter, and said, icily, "As a policeman, Your Grace, does your jurisdiction extend to the shires?" Another ring in the water, thought the angler inside Vimes's head. He said, "No, madam, my beat is Ankh-Morpork and some of the surrounding area. Traditionally, however, the policeman drags his jurisdiction with him if he is in hot pursuit in connection with a crime committed within his domain. But, of course, Ankh-Morpork is a long way from here, and I doubt if I'd be able to run that far." This got a laugh from the table in general, and a thin-lipped smile from Mrs. Colonel. "Play the fish, play the fish." "Nevertheless," Vimes continued, "if I was to witness an arrestable offence here and now, I'd have the authority to make an arrest. Like a citizen's arrest, but somewhat more professional. And after that, I'd be required to turn the suspect over to local force or other suitable authority as I deemed fit." The clergyman, whom Vimes had noticed out of the corner of his eye, was taking an interest in his conversation, leaned forward to say, "As you deem fit, Your Grace." "My Grace would not come into it, sir. As a sworn member of the Ankh-Morpork City Watch, it would be my bounden duty to ensure the safety of my suspect. Ideally, I'd look for a lock-up. We don't have them in the city anymore, but I understand most rural areas still do, even if they only hold drunks and escaped pigs." There was laughter, and Miss Beadle said, "We do have a village constable, Your Grace, but he keeps pigs in the lock-up down by the old bridge." She looked brightly at Vimes, whose expression was stony. He said, "Does he ever put people in there? Does he have a warrant card? Does he have a badge?" "Well, he puts the occasional drunk in there to sober up, and says the pigs don't seem to mind, but I have no idea what a warrant card is." There was more laughter at this, but it faded quickly, sucked into nowhere by Vimes's implacable silence. Then he said, "I would not consider him to be a policeman, and, until I found that he was working within a framework of proper law enforcement, I would regard him not as a policeman by my standards, but as a slightly bossy street cleaner. Of some use, but not a policeman."
"By your standards, Your Grace?" said the clergyman.
"Yes, sir, by my standards, my decision, my responsibility, my experience, my arse if things go wrong."
"But, Your Grace, as you say, you are outside your jurisdiction here," said Mrs. Colonel gently.
Vimes could sense her husband's nervousness. It was certainly not to do with the food. The man was wishing heartily that he wasn't there. It was funny how people always wanted to talk to policemen about crime and never realised what strange little signals their anxieties betrayed. He turned to the man's wife, smiled, and said, "But, as I've said, madam, if a copper comes across a flagrant crime, his jurisdiction reaches out to him like an old friend. And do you mind if we change the subject? No offence meant to any of you ladies and gentlemen, but over the years I've noticed that bankers and military men and merchants all get a chance to eat their dinners at their leisure at affairs like this, while the poor old copper has to talk about police work, which is, most of the time, rather dull." He smiled again to keep everything friendly and went on, "Exceedingly dull around here, I would imagine.
From my point of view, this place is as quiet as the grave.
Score. One wince from the dear old colonel, and the priest looking down at his plate, although the latter shouldn't be taken too seriously, he thought, because you seldom saw a clergyman who couldn't strike sparks with his knife and fork. Sybil, using her hostess voice, shattered the silence like an icebreaker.
"I think it's time for the main course," she said, "which will be superb mutton, avec no talking about police work at all. Honestly, if you get Sam going, he'll quote the laws and ordinances of Ankh Morpork and force standing orders until you throw a cushion at him."
"Well done," Vimes thought. "At least I can now eat my dinner in peace." He relaxed as the conversation around him became less fraught and once again replete with the everyday gossip and grumblings about other people living in the area, the difficulties with servants, the prospects for the harvest, and, oh yes, the trouble with goblins. Vimes paid attention, then. Goblins. The City Watch appeared to contain at least one member of every known bipedal sapient species, plus one Nobby Nobs. It had become a tradition. If you could make it as a copper, then you could make it as a species. But nobody had ever once suggested that Vimes should employ a goblin, the simple reason being that they were universally known to be stinking, cannibalistic, vicious, untrustworthy bastards. Of course, everybody knew that dwarfs were a chiseling bunch who would swindle you if they could, and that trolls were little more than thugs, and the city's one resident Medusa would never look you in the face, and the vampires couldn't be trusted however much they smiled, and werewolves were only vampires who couldn't fly when you got right down to it. And the man next door was a real bastard who threw his rubbish over your wall, and his wife was no better than she should be. But then again, it took all sorts to make a world. It was not as if you were prejudiced, because, after all, there had been an orc working at the university. But he liked his football, didn't he, just? And you could forgive anyone who could score from the centre spot. And, well, you took as you found. But not bloody goblins, thank you very much. People hounded them out as they came into the city, and intended to end up downriver, working for the likes of Harry King in the bone-grinding, leather-tanning and scrap-metal industries. A fair walk outside the city gates, and so outside the law. And now there were some in the vicinity of the hall, as evidenced by chickens and cats disappearing and so on. Well, probably, but Vimes remembered when people said that trolls stole chickens. It was nothing of interest to a troll in a chicken. It would be like humans eating plaster. He certainly did not mention any of this. Yes, no one had a good word to say about goblins, but Miss Beadle had no word to say at all. Her gaze remained firmly fixed on Vimes's face. You could read a dining table if you learned the knack, and if you were a policeman, then you could build a clear picture of what each diner thought about the others. It was all in the looks, the things said or not said. The people who were in the magic circle and the people who weren't. Miss Beadle was an outsider, tolerated because obviously there is such a thing as good manners, but not exactly included. What was the phrase? Not one of us. Vimes realised that he was staring at Miss Beadle just as she was staring at him. They both smiled, and he thought that an inquisitive man would go and see the nice lady who had written the books that his little boy enjoyed so much, and not because she looked like someone prepared to blow so many whistles that it would sound like a pipe band. Miss Beadle frowned a lot when the talk was about goblins, and occasionally people, especially the people he had tagged as Mrs. Colonel, would cast a look at her as one might glance at a child who was doing something wrong. And so he maintained a nice exterior air of attention, while at the same time sifting through the affairs of the day. The process was interrupted by Mrs. Colonel saying, "By the way, Your Grace, we were very pleased to hear that you gave Jefferson a drubbing this afternoon. The man is insufferable. He upsets people."
"Well, I notice he's not afraid to air his views," said Vimes, "but nor are we, are we?"
"But surely you, of all people, Your Grace," said the clergyman, looking up earnestly, "cannot possibly believe that Jack is as good as his master."
"Depends on Jack. Depends on the master. Depends what you mean by good," said Vimes. "I suppose I was a Jack, but when it comes to the Ankh Morpork City Watch, I am the master."
Mrs. Colonel was about to answer when Lady Sybil said brightly, "Talking of which, Sam, I had a letter from a Mrs. Wainwright commending you highly. Remind me to show it to you." All long-term couples have their code. Classically, there is one that the wife uses in polite conversation to warn her husband that, because of hasty dressing or absent-mindedness, he is becoming exposed in the crotch department. See Dr. Bentley Purchase, "The Vicar is Coming to Tea," and 127 other warnings of social embarrassment, Unseen University Press. In the case of Vimes and Lady Sybil, any mention of Mrs. Wainwright was a code that meant, if you don't stop annoying people, Sam Vimes, then there will be a certain amount of marriageable discord later this evening. But this time Sam Vimes wanted the last word, and said, "In fact, come to think of it, I know quite a few risen jacks in various places, and let me tell you, they often make better masters than their erstwhile masters ever did. All they needed was a chance. Do remind me to show you the letter, Sam." Vimes gave in, and the arrival of the ice cream pudding lowered the temperature somewhat, especially since her ladyship made certain that everybody's glasses remained filled, and in the case of the Colonel, this meant an extremely regular top-up. Vimes would have liked to talk to him further, but he too was under wifely orders. The man had definitely had something important on his mind that caused the presence of a policeman to make him very nervous indeed, and the nervousness was apparently catching. This wasn't a posh affair by any means. Sybil had organised this little party before building up to anything more lavish, and some fairly amicable goodbyes were being said long before 11. Vimes listened intently to the Colonel and his wife as they walked, in his case unsteadily, to their carriage. All he heard, however, was a hissed, "You had the stable door open all evening," followed by a growl,
"Yeah, the horse was fast asleep, my dear."
When the last carriage had been waved away and the big front door firmly shut, Sybil said, "Well, Sam, I understand, I really do, but they were our guests."
"I know, and I'm sorry, but it's as if they don't think. I just wanted to shake their ideas up a bit."
Lady Sybil examined a sherry bottle and topped up her glass. "Surely you don't think that the blacksmith really had the right to fight you for this house?" Sam wished that he could drink right now.
"No, of course not. I mean, there wouldn't be an end to it. People have been winning and losing on the old roulette wheel of fate for thousands of years. I know that. But you know that I think that if you're going to stop the wheel, then you have to spare some thought for the poor buggers who are sitting on zero."
His wife gently took his hand. "But we endowed the hospital, Sam. You know how expensive that is. Dr. Lorne will train up anyone who shows an aptitude for medicine, even if they, in his words, turn up with the arse hanging out of their trousers. He's even letting girls train as doctors. He even employs egorinas. We're changing things, Sam, a bit at a time, by helping people help themselves. And look at the watch. These days, a kid is proud to say that his father, or even his mother, is a watchman. And people need pride." Vimes grasped her hand. He said, "Thank you for being kind to the boy from Cockbill Street." She laughed this away. "I waited a long time for you to turn up, Samuel Vimes, and I don't intend to let you go to waste." This seemed to Sam Vimes a good time to say, "You don't mind if Willikins and I take a little stroll to Dead Man's Copse before I go to bed?" Lady Sybil gave him the smile women give to husbands and small boys. "Well, I can hardly say no, and there is a strange atmosphere. I'm glad Willikins is involved, and it's very pleasant up there. Perhaps you'll hear the nightingale." Vimes gave her a little kiss before going up to change and said, "Actually, dear, I'm hoping to hear a canary." Probably no duke or even commander of the city watch had found in their dressing room anything like that which lay on the bed of Sam Vimes right now. Pride of place was for a billhook, which was a useful agricultural implement. He had seen a couple of them being carried earlier in the day. He reminded himself that agricultural implement did not mean not a weapon. They turned up sometimes among the street gangs and were almost as much to be feared as a troll with a headache. Then there was a truncheon, Vimes's own truncheon, which his manservant had thoughtfully brought along. Of course, it had silverwork on it, because it was the ceremonial truncheon of the commander of the watch, and wasn't a weapon at all, oh dear me, no. On the other hand, Vimes knew himself not to be a cheesemonger, and therefore it would be somewhat difficult to explain why he had a foot of cheese wire about his person. That was going to stay here, but he'd take the billhook. It was a pretty poor lookout if a man walking on his own land couldn't take the opportunity to trim a branch or two. But what to make of the pile of bamboo, which resolved itself into a breastplate of articulated sections and a most unfetching bamboo helmet? There was a small note on the bed. It said, in Willikins' handwriting, "The gamekeeper's friend, Commander, yours too." Vimes grunted and hit the breastplate with his truncheon. It flexed like a living thing, and the truncheon bounced across the room. "Well, we live and learn," Vimes thought. "Or perhaps, more importantly, we learn and live." He crept downstairs and let himself out into the night, which was a checkerboard of black and white. He'd forgotten that outside the city, where the smogs, smokes and steams rendered the world into a thousand shades of grey, out in places like this, there was black and white, and if you were looking for a metaphor, there was one right there. He knew the way to the hill, you couldn't miss it. The moon illuminated the way as if it had wanted to make things easier for him. Actual agriculture ran out around here. The fields gave way to furze and to turf nibbled by rabbits into something resembling the bays of a snooker table. Although, given that rabbits did other things than just eat grass, he would play snooker with a lot of very small balls. Bunnies scattered as he climbed, and he worried that he was making too much noise. But it was his land, and therefore this was just a walk in the park. So he walked a little more jauntily, following what seemed to be the only path, and saw, in the moonlight, the gibbet. Well, he thought, it says Dead Man's Copse on the map, doesn't it? They used to do a lot of things like this in the old days, didn't they? And the metal cage was just there to keep the corpses upright, so that the ravens didn't have to kneel. Good old-fashioned policing, you could call it, if you wanted to chill a spine or two. A pile of crumbling ancient bones at the foot of the gibbet testified to the old-fashioned policing at work. Vimes felt the stealthy movement of a knife on the hairs of his neck. A moment later, Willikins got up off the ground and fastidiously brushed dirt from his clothing. "Oh, well done, sir," he said, wheezing a little, owing to the shortness of breath. "I can see that I can't put anything across you, Commander." He stopped, held his hand up to his nose and sniffed. "Blow me down, Commander. There's blood all over my clothes. You didn't stick me, did you, sir? You just spun around and kicked me in the nuts, which I may say, sir, was done most expertly." Vimes sniffed. You learn to smell blood. It smelled like metal. Now, people would say that metal doesn't smell, but it does. It smells like blood. "You got up here on time," he said. "Yes, sir. Didn't see a living soul." Willikins knelt down. "Didn't see a thing. Wouldn't have seen the blood if you hadn't kicked me into a puddle of it. It's all over the place." "I wish I had an eagle here," thought Vimes. These days he handed over the forensic to the experts. On the other hand, you acquired forensic skill of your own, and beyond the smell of blood he could smell butchery and unbelievable coincidence. Everybody sees everything in the countryside. Jefferson was going to meet Vimes, but here there was a definite shortage of Jefferson, and no shortage whatsoever of blood, while at the same time a noticeable absence of corpse. Vimes' brain worked through things methodically. Of course, you took it for granted that if a citizen was surreptitiously going to tell a policeman a secret, it was likely that somebody did not wish said citizen to say said thing. And if said citizen was found dead, then said policeman, who had been seen to have a scrap with him earlier, might just be considered to be a tiny bit guilty when all is said and done. And while all was being said and all was being done, someone really intent on getting Vimes into difficulties would have left the corpse of the blacksmith there, wouldn't they? "Found something, sir," said Willikins, straightening up. "You what?" "Found something, sir. Felt on the ground, as you might say." "But it's soaked with blood, man." This didn't seem to worry Willikins. "Never minded blood, Commander. The least ways when it wasn't mine." There was some scrabbling, then light appeared. Willikins had shifted the trap door of a dark lantern. He handed it to Vimes and then held something small to the glow. "It's a ring, sir. Looks like it's been made of stone." "What, you mean it's a stone with a hole in it?" He heard Willikins sigh. "No, sir, it's polished smooth, and there's a claw in it. Looks like goblin to me." Vimes thought, all that blood, severed claw, goblins aren't that big. Somebody bothered to come up here to kill a goblin. Where's the rest of it? In theory, moonlight should help the search, but moonlight is deceptive, creating shadows where shadows should not be, and the wind was getting up. Dark lantern or not, there was little he could do here. The curtains were drawn, and a few lights still burned in the goblin's head. Apparently, there were licensing laws. A good copper should always be ready to test the strength of them. He led the way round to the back of the pub and knocked on the little wooden sliding panel set into the building's back door. After a few moments, Jiminy pulled the sliding panel aside, and Vimes stuck his hand in the hole before the man could close it again. "Not you, please, Your Grace. The magistrates will have my guts for garters." "And I'm sure they'll be very decorative," said Vimes, "but it won't happen because I'll warrant that about a third of your regular customers are still imbibing intoxicating liquors at this hour, and probably at least one magistrate is among them." "No, I take back that last remark. Magistrates do their drinking at home where there are no licensing laws. I won't say a word, but it'll be a bad old day for the job if a thirsty copper can't mump a night-time beverage from a former colleague." He slapped some coins on the tiny shelf inside the little panel and added, "That should buy double brandy for my man here, and for me the address of Mr. Jefferson the Smith." "You can't treat me like this, you know." Vimes looked at Willikins. "Can I?" The gentleman's gentleman cleared his throat.
"We are now in the world of feudal law, Commander. You own the ground this public house stands on, but he has rights as strong as your own. If he has paid his rent, then you can't even go into the property without his permission."
"How do you know all this stuff?"
"Well, Commander, as you know, I've had one or two holidays in the Tantee in my time, and one thing about prison is that there are always a lot of books about the law lying around, criminals being very keen on going through the old legal small print, just in case it turns out that giving a rival gang member some cement boots and dropping him in the river might be legal after all. That kind of learning sticks. But I'm investigating a mysterious disappearance now. The blacksmith was very keen to see me up the hill, but when I got up there, there was nothing but a lead of blood all over the place. Jefferson wanted to tell me something, and you must know what that smells like to a copper."
"Even though I'm not sure," said Vimes to himself.
"Definitely something iffy, that's for sure."
The landlord shrugged.
"Not my business, squire."
Vimes's hand gripped the landlord's wrist before the man could pull it away, and tugged him so hard that his face was up against the woodwork.
"Don't you squire me. There's something going on down here, something wrong. I can feel it in my boots, and believe me, they are the most sensitive boots that ever were. The man who runs the village pub knows everything. I know that, and so do you. If you're not on my side, you're in my way, and you know something. I can see it in your eyes. If it turns out you knew something of importance about the blacksmith, you'll have invited yourself to be an accessory after the fact, with a free option, if I can get the bit between my teeth, of before the fact, which leaves you right in the middle, and that's a fact."
Jiminy wriggled, but Vimes's grip was steely.
"Your badge doesn't work here, Mr. Vimes, you know that."
Vimes heard the tiny whine of fear in the man's voice, but old coppers were tough. If you weren't tough, you never became an old copper.
"I'm going to let go, sir," said Vimes, which is policeman's code for trembling arsehole. "You think that legally around here I don't have a leg to stand on. This may or may not be true, but my man here is not a policeman and is not accustomed to doing things nicely like we in the job do, and you might end up without a leg to stand on as well. I'm telling you this as a friend. We both know this game, eh? I expect you were working in the bar when the goblin was killed, yes?"
"I didn't know a bloody goblin was killed, did I? So how would I know when it may or may not have happened? My advice, sir," said Jiminy, with the same coded inflection that Vimes had used, "would be to report the matter to the authorities in the morning. That would be young Upshot, calls himself a copper. Look, I came here to retire, Vimes, and staying alive is part of that. I do not poke my nose into that which does not concern me. And I know there's a lot of things that you could do, and I know you ain't going to do them. But just so's you don't go home empty-handed, Jethro lives where all blacksmiths live, right in the centre of the village, overlooking the green. He lives with his old mum, so I wouldn't disturb her at this time of night. And now, gents, I'd better shut the pub. Don't want to break the law."
The panel slid back, and there was the sound of a bolt slotting into place. A moment later, to the time-honoured cry of, "Ain't you lot got no homes to go to?" they heard the front door open, and the lane filled with men trying to get their brains to go in the direction of their feet, or vice versa. In the shadows of the pub's backyard, which smelled of old barrels, Willikins said, "Would you like to take a bet on whether your blacksmith is tucked up in his bed tonight, sir?"
"No," said Vimes,
"but this stinks to me. I think I've got a murder, but I haven't got a corpse, not all of it, anyway," he said, as Willikins opened his mouth. He grunted. "For it to be definitely murder, Willikins, you need to be missing an important bit of you that you really need to stay alive, like your head, okay, or like your blood. But it's difficult to collect that in the dark, isn't it?" They set off, and Vimes said, "The one thing you can say about the dead is that they stay dead, well, generally speaking, and so it's been a long day, and that's a long walk, and old age is creeping on, okay?"
"Not very noticeably from the outside, Commander," said Willikins loyally.
The door was opened to them by a yawning night footman, and as soon as he had retired, Willikins produced from the pocket of his coat the reeking and severed goblin claw and placed it on the hall table.
"Not much to a goblin once you get past the head, or so they say. See, there's the ring on the finger. Definitely looks like stone. Pretty good workmanship for a goblin."
"Animals don't wear jewellery," said Vimes. "You know, Willikins, I've said it before, you'd make a bloody good copper if it wasn't for the fact that you'd make a bloody good assassin."
Willikins grinned.
"I did think about the assassin when I was a lad, sir, but unfortunately I was not of the right social class, and besides, they have rules."
He helped Vimes out of his jacket and went on. "The street don't have rules, Commander, except one, which is survive. And my dear old dad would probably turn in his grave if I even thought of being a copper." "But I thought you never knew who your father was."
"Indeed, sir, that is the case, but one must consider the fact of heredity."
Willikins produced a small brush and whisked a speck of dirt off the coat before putting it on a hanger, then went on, "I do feel the absence of a parent sometimes, and I have wondered whether it might be a sensible idea to go along to the cemetery at Small Gods and shout out, 'Dad, I'm going to be a copper,' and then see which gravestone revolved, sir." The man was still grinning. Vimes reflected, and not for the first time, that he had quite an unusual gentleman to be a gentleman's gentleman, especially given that neither of them was a gentleman in the first place. "Willikins, and I mean this most sincerely, if I were you, I'd go instead down to the Tanty and shout it out into the lime pit next to the gallows."
Willikins' grin widened.
"Thank you, sir.
I don't have to tell you that that means a lot to me. If you'd excuse me, sir, I'll go and put my jacket in the incinerator before retiring."
Sybil turned over and made a big warm noise when Vimes got into bed next to her. It had been a long day, and he dropped into that pink, semi-conscious stupor that is even better than sleep, waking up slightly every hour when nobody rang a bell in the street below to say that all was well. And he woke up again to hear the sound of heavy cartwheels rumbling over stones. Half asleep as Vimes was, suspicion woke him the rest of the way. Stones? It was all bloody gravel around the hall. He opened a window and stared out into the moonlight. It was an echo bouncing off the hills. A few brain cells doing the night shift wondered what kind of agriculture had to be done at night. Did they grow mushrooms? Did turnips have to be brought in from the cold? Was that what they called crop rotation? These thoughts melted into his somnolent brain like little grains of sugar into a cup of tea, slithering and dripping from cell to synapse to neurotransmitter, until it arrived in the receptor marked suspicion, which, if you saw a medical diagram of a policeman's brain, would probably be quite a visible lump, slightly larger than the lump marked ability to understand long words. He thought, ah yes, contraband, and, feeling cheerful and hopeful for the future, he gently closed the window and went back to bed. The food at the hall was copious and sumptuous and quite probably very nearly everything else ending in us. Vimes was old enough to know that the senior staff got to eat the leftovers and therefore made certain there would be leftovers. With this in mind, he had a very large helping of haddock kedgeree and ate all four rashers of bacon on his plate. Sybil tutted about this, and Vimes pointed out that he was on holiday after all, and on holiday you did not do the things you did on other days, causing Sybil, with forensic accuracy, to point out that this should therefore include police work, should it not. But Vimes was ready, and said that of course he understood this, which was why he was going to take young Sam for a walk down to the centre of the village to put his suspicions in the hands of the local policeman. Sybil said, "All right then," in deliberate tones of disbelief, and he was to be sure to take Willikins with him. This was another aspect of his wife that puzzled Vimes to the core. In the same way that Sybil thought that Nobby Nobbs, although a rough diamond, was a good watchman, she thought that Vimes was safer in the company of a man who never moved abroad without the weaponry of the street about his person, and who had once opened a beer bottle with somebody else's teeth. This was true, but in some ways very disconcerting. He heard the doorbell ring, heard the footman open the front door, heard a muffled conversation followed by somebody walking on the gravel path round the back of the hall. It wasn't important, it was just ambience, and the sound of a footman coming into the room and whispering to Sybil fell into the same category. He heard her say, "What? Oh, well, I suppose you better show him in." Then snapped to attention when she addressed him. "It's the local policeman. Can you see him in the study? Policemen never wipe their feet properly, especially you, Sam." Vimes hadn't seen the study yet. The hall never seemed to run out of rooms. By dint of being pointed the way by a swivelling maid, he arrived in the study a few seconds before the local copper was shown in by a footman, who made a face like a man having to handle a dead rat. At least, it was presumably the local copper. He looked like the local copper's son. 17 years old, Vimes reckoned, and he smelled of pigs. He stood where the footman had deposited him, and stared. After a while, Vimes said, "Can I help you, officer?" The young man blinked.
Am I addressing Sir Samuel Vimes?
Who are you?" This query appeared to take the young man by surprise, and after a while Vimes took pity on him and said, "Look, son, the correct drill is to say who you are and then ask me if I am me, so to speak. After all, I don't know who you are. You're not wearing a uniform I recognise. You have shown me no warrant card or badge, and you don't have a helmet.
I assume, nevertheless, and for the purposes of concluding this interview before lunchtime, that you are the chief constable in this vicinity. What's your name?
Upshot, sir. Feeny Upshot. Chief Constable Upshot?
Vimes felt ashamed of himself, but this kid was representing himself as a police officer, and even Nobby Nobbs would have laughed. Aloud, he said, "Well, Chief Constable Upshot, I am Sir Samuel Vimes, amongst other things, and I was thinking only just now that I should talk to you."
That's good, sir, because I was thinking only just now that it was about time I should arrest you on suspicion of causing the death of Jethro Jefferson the Smith."
Vimes' expression did not change. "So, what do I do now?"
"Nothing, that's what.
You have the right to remain silent. I've said that to hundreds of people, knowing it for the rubbish that it is, and I'm absolutely certain of one other thing, that I certainly haven't laid anything more than an educational hand on that damned blacksmith, and therefore it's going to be very interesting to find out why this little twerp thinks he can feel my collar for doing so." A copper should always be willing to learn, and Vimes had learned from Lord Vetinari that you should never react to any comment or situation until you had decided exactly what you were going to do. This had the dual attraction of preventing you from saying or doing the wrong thing, while at the same time making other people extremely nervous.
"Sorry about that, sir, but it took me an hour to get the pigs out and make the lock-up comfortable, sir. It still smells a bit of disinfectant, sir, and pig, if it comes to that, but I whitewashed the walls, and there's a chair and a bed you can curl up on. Oh, and so you don't get bored, I found the magazine."
He looked hopefully at Vimes, whose expression had not changed, merely calcified. But after a suitably long stare, Vimes said, "Which magazine?"
"Sir, I didn't know there was more than one. We've always had it. It's about pigs. It's a bit worn now, but pigs is always pigs."
Vimes stood up. "I'm going to go for a walk, Chief Constable. You can follow me if you like."
"Sorry, sir, but I've arrested you."
"No, son, you haven't," said Vimes, heading towards the front door.
"But I definitely told you that you were arrested, sir."
It was almost a wail. Vimes opened the front door and started down the steps with Feeny trotting along behind him. A couple of gardeners who would otherwise have turned away leaned on their brooms at the sight, suspecting a cabaret.
"What in the world have you got on you that tells me you are an official policeman?" inquired Vimes over his shoulder. "I have the official truncheon, sir. It's a family heirloom."
Sam Vimes stopped walking and turned.
"Well, my lad, if it's official, then you'd better let me look at it, hadn't you? Come on, hand it over."
Feeny did so. It was just an oversized blackjack, with the word law inexpertly burnt into it with maybe a poker.
"Good weight, though."
Vimes tapped it in his palm and said, "You've given me to understand that you believe that I'm potentially a murderer, and you've handed your weapon to me. Don't you think that's unwise?" Vimes saw the landscape drift past as he floated over the terrace and landed on his back in a flowerbed, staring at the sky. Feeny's concerned face, somewhat overlarge, appeared in his vision.
"Sorry about that, Commander. Personally, I wouldn't hurt you for anything, but I didn't want to give you the wrong impression. That move translates as one man he up down very sorry."
Vimes watched the patch of sky above him in a state of inexplicable peace as the boy said,
"You see, my granddad worked on tall ships when he was a lad, sailing over to Bang Bang Duck and all them places where folks is so strange. When he came back, he bought my granny, Ming Chang, and she taught that to my dad and to me."
He sniffed.
"She died a few months ago, but at least she taught my mum cookery too. Bung Ming Suck Dog is still a favourite in these parts, and, of course, it's not too difficult to get the ingredients, being so close to the sea. Bong Can Bang Keng doesn't grow very well round here, although Packed Shop Chop Muck Dick grows pretty well." "Oh, the colour is going back to your face, sir, I'm very pleased to say."
Aching at every joint, Vimes pulled himself upright.
"Don't do that again, do you hear?"
"I'll try not to do so, sir, but you are under arrest, sir."
"I told you, young man, you have not properly arrested me."
Vimes got to his feet, wheezing a little.
"In order to effect a legal arrest, the arresting officer must be physically touching the suspect while clearly uttering the words, 'I arrest you,' like this, although at that time you need not specify the crime of which your suspect is suspected. While so doing," and here Vimes punched the boy so hard in the solar plexus that he curled up, "it pays to take care, which you are going to need to do, my lad, if you intend to arrest me, which I may point out you still have not done, which is a shame, because if you had, you would now have a clear case against me for resisting arrest, as well as assaulting a policeman in the execution of his duty.
with the proviso that nothing about you so far leads me to believe that you truly are a policeman.
Vimes sat down on a handy stone and watched as Feeney began to unfold.
I'm Sam Vimes, young man, so don't try that chop Sally stuff on me, understand?
Now Feeney's voice was a sort of attenuated wheeze.
And one day someone will say to you, do you know who I am, Constable? To which you will reply, yes, sir, or as it may be, madam, you are the person I am interviewing in connection with the aforesaid crime, or similar appropriate wording, which should not include such phrases as, you are going down, chummy, or I've got you bang to rights and no mistake. Ignore, but remember, all threats made, the law is one and immutable. It does not care who anybody is, and at that moment you, in a very real way, are it, and therefore nor do you.
Vimes sat with his mouth open, and Feeney continued,
we don't often get the Times over here. I bought a load of pig medicine a year ago, and it was wrapped in the Times, and I saw your name when you spoke about being a policeman. It made me feel very proud, sir.
Vimes remembered that speech. He'd had to write it for the passing out parade of some newly trained officers from the Watch School. He'd spent hours trying to get it down, hampered by the fact that for him any form of literature was in every sense a closed book. He'd shown it to Sybil and asked her whether she thought he should get somebody to help him with it, and she had patted him on the head and said, no, dear, because then it would look like something written by somebody for somebody else, whereas right now the pure Vimes shows through like a radiant beacon. That had quite cheered him up, because he'd never been a radiant beacon before. But now his heart sank as his train of thought was interrupted by a very polite cough and the voice of Willikins, who said, excuse me, Commander, I thought it right at this time to introduce the young gentleman to my friends Mr. Burley and Mr. Strong in the arm. Lady Sybil would not be happy to see you arrested, Commander. I fear that you would find her a bit acerbic, sir. Vimes found his voice. You're a bloody fool, man. Put that damn thing down. You keep it on a hair trigger. Put it down right now. Willikins wordlessly set down the shining crossbow on the parapet of the staircase, like a mother putting her baby to bed. There was a twang, and 17 yards away a geranium was decapitated. This passed without notice, except by the geranium and a raggedy figure hiding in the rhododendrons that said snack to itself, but resolutely carried on staring at Vimes. The tableau of shock on the steps was interrupted by Lady Sybil, who could walk very quietly for a large woman.
Gentlemen, what is going on here?
This young man, allegedly the local policeman, wishes to take me into custody on a charge of suspicion of murder, my dear. There passed between husband and wife a look that deserved the status of telepathy. Sybil stared at Feeney.
Ah, you would be young Upshot, I suppose. I was sorry to hear about the death of your father, and I do trust that your mother continues well. I used to visit her when I was a girl. And you want to arrest my husband, do you?
Feeney, goggle-eyed, managed an unprofessional...
Yes, ma'am.
Sybil sighed and said sternly,
well, then, can I hope that at least this can be done without further vegetable carnage?
She looked at Vimes.
Is he taking you to prison?
She turned her attention back to Feeney, a man now confronted by a cannon loaded with 1,000 years of upper-class self-assurance.
He'll need fresh clothing, Constable. If you tell me where you're taking him, and you will tell me where you're taking him, I will personally bring down suitable garments. Will I need to sew the stripes on them, or does that happen automatically? And I would be grateful if you had him back here by tea time, because we're expecting visitors.
Lady Sybil took a step forward, and Feeney took a step backwards to escape the wrath of the impending bosom. She said,
may I wish you the best of luck in your undertaking, young man? You'll need it. Now, please excuse me, I have to go and talk to the cook.
She swept away, leaving the incredulous Feeney staring after her. Then the doors that had just closed behind her opened again, and she said,
are you still a bachelor, young man?
Feeney managed to, yes.
Then you are invited to tea, she said cheerfully. There are some very eligible young ladies coming, and I'm sure that they will be most excited to see a young man who is prepared to dance on the very edge of hell. Do wear your helmet, Sam, in case there is any police brutality. Willikins, come with me. I want to have a talk to you.
Vimes let the silence curdle. After too much of it, Feeney said,
your wife is a very remarkable woman, sir.
Vimes nodded. You have no idea.
What do you want to do now, Chief Constable?
The boy hesitated. That was Sybil for you. Just by speaking calmly and confidently, she could leave you believing that the world had turned upside down and dropped onto your head.
Well, sir, I believe I must take you before the magistrates.
Vimes noticed a little question mark.
Who is your boss, Feeney?
The aforesaid bench of magistrates, sir. Vimes began to walk down the steps, and Feeney hurried after him.
Vimes waited until the boy was racing, and then stopped dead so that Feeney ran into him.
"Your boss is the law, Chief Constable, and don't you forget it. In fact, one of the jobs of the magistrates is to make certain that you do not. Did you ever take an oath? What did it say? Who was it to?"
"Oh, I remember that all right, sir. It was to the bench of magistrates, sir."
"It was what?" "You made an oath to obey the magistrates. They can't make you do that."
He stopped. "Remember, in the country there is always somebody watching you," he thought, "and probably listening too."
Feeney looked shocked, so Vimes said, "Get me down to your lock-up, kid, and lock me in. And while you're about it, lock yourself in with me. Don't rush, don't ask questions, and keep your voice down, apart from possibly saying things like, 'I have you banged to rights, you miscreant,' and other rubbish of that general nature, because, young man, I believe somebody is in real difficulties here, and I believe that person is you. If you have any sense, you'll keep quiet and take me to your lock-up, okay?"
Eyes wide, Feeney nodded. It was a pleasant walk down to the lock-up, which turned out to be on a small quay by the river. The area had all the semi-nautical detritus that a man might expect, and there was a swing bridge, presumably to allow the bigger boats to pass. The sun shone, and nothing was happening, in a slow sort of way. And then there was the much-spoken-of lock-up. It looked like a giant pepper pot built of stone. A flowering creeper grew up it, and, next to the door, and restrained by a chain, there was an enormous pig. When it saw their approach, it got on its hind legs, and, tottering somewhat, begged.
"Now this is Masher," said Feeney. "His father was a wild boar, his mother was surprised. See those fangs? No one gives me much trouble when I threaten to let Masher off his lead, do they, Masher?"
He disappeared behind the lock-up, and returned immediately with the bucket of swill, into which Masher tried to bury himself, with hugely contented noises, as huge, in fact, as his fangs. Vimes was staring at them when a friendly-looking woman, wearing an apron, bustled out of a thatched cottage, stopped when she saw Vimes and dropped a curtsy. She looked hopefully at Feeney.
"Who would this fine gentleman be, son?" "It's Commander Vimes, mum, you know, the Duke."
There was a pause while the woman clearly wished that she had been wearing a better dress, a hairdo and shoes, and had cleaned the privy, the kitchen, the scullery, and had tidied up the garden, painted the front door, and cleaned the inside of the roof. Vimes prevented her spin from making a hole in the ground by holding out his hand and saying, "Sam Vimes, madam, pleased to make your acquaintance." But this only caused her to run indoors in a panic.
"My mum is very keen on the aristocracy," Feeney confided, as he unlocked the door of the lock-up with an unfeasibly large key.
"Why?" said Vimes, mystified. It was reasonably comfortable in the lock-up. Granted, the pigs had left a fragrant memory behind them, but for a boy from Ankh-Morpork, this counted as fresh air. Feeney sat down beside him on a well-scrubbed bench.
"Well, sir, when my granddad was young, Lord Ramkin gave him a whole half-dollar for opening a gate, just to let the hunt go by. According to my dad, he said, no canting hypocrite going on about the rights of man ever gave me as much as a quarter farthing, so I say, here's to Lord Ramkin, who gave me a whole half-dollar when he was as pissed as a fart, and never asked for it back when he was sober. That's what I call a gentleman."
Vimes squirmed inside, knowing that the supposedly generous old drunkard would have had more money than you could ever imagine, and here was a working man pathetically grateful for a handout from the old piss artist. He snarled in his soul to a man long dead. But the part of him that had been married to Sybil for years whispered, but he didn't have to give the man anything, and in those days a whole half-dollar was probably more money than the old man could imagine. Once Sybil, in one of their very infrequent arguments, had surprised him by blurting out,
"Well, Sam, my family got its start in life, its grubstake, if you like, by piracy. You should like that, Sam, good, honest manual labour, and look what it led to. The trouble with you, Sam Vimes, is that you're determined to be your very own class enemy."
"Is there something wrong, Commander?" said Feeney.
"Everything," said Vimes. "For one thing, no policeman swears allegiance to the civil power. He swears allegiance to the law. Oh, politicians can change the law, and if the copper doesn't like it, then he can quit. But while he is in the job, it's up to him to act in accordance with the law as laid down."
He leaned his back against the stone wall. "You do not swear to obey magistrates. I'd like to see what it was that you signed." Vimes stopped talking because the little metal plate in the lock-up door slid open to reveal Feeney's mother, looking very nervous.
I've made bang suck duck feeny with Sweden chips, and there's enough for the Duke as well, if you would be so condescending as to accept it."
Vimes leaned forward and whispered, "Does she know you've arrested me?"
Feeny shuddered. "No, and, sir, please, please don't tell her, because I think she'd never let me into the house ever again."
Vimes walked over to the door and said to the slot, "I shall be honoured by your hospitality, Mistress Upshot." There was a nervous giggle from the other side of the slot, and Feeny's mother managed to say, "I'm sorry to say we have no silver plates, Your Highness." At home, Vimes and Sybil ate off serviceable earthenware, cheap, practical, and easy to keep clean. He said aloud, "I'm sorry you don't have any silver plates too, Mistress Upshot, and I'll have a set sent to you directly." There was something like a scuffle from the other side of the slot, at the same time as Feeny said, "I beg your pardon, have you gone mad, sir?" Well, that would help, Vimes thought. "We've got hundreds of damned silver plates up at the old mine, lad. Bloody useless. They make the food cold and they turn black as soon as your back is turned. We'd be overrun with spoons, too. I'll see what we've got." "You can't do that, sir. She gets scared of having valuables in the house." "Do you have much theft hereabouts, Chief Constable?" said Vimes, emphasising the last two words. Mr. Feeny opened the door of the lock-up and picked up his mother, who had apparently been stunned by the possibility of owning silver plates, brushed her down and said over her shoulder, "No, sir, the reason being no one has anything to steal. My mum always told me money can't buy you happiness, sir." "Yes," Vimes thought, "so did my ma, but she was glad enough when I gave her my first wages, because it meant we could have a meal with meat in it, even if we didn't know what kind of meat it was. That's happiness, isn't it? Blimey, the lies we tell ourselves." When a blushing Mistress Upshot had gone to fetch the meal, Vimes said, "Between ourselves, Chief Constable, do you believe that I'm guilty of murder?"
"No, sir," said Feeny instantly.
"You said that very quickly, young man. Are you going to say that it's copper's instinct? Because I get the impression you ain't been a copper long and haven't had much to do. I'm no expert, but I don't reckon pigs try lying to you very much either." Feeny took a deep breath. "Well, sir," he said calmly, "my granddad was a wily old bird, and he could read people like books. He used to walk me around the area introducing me to people, sir, and then as they strolled along he'd tell me their stories, like the one about the man who'd been caught in flagrante delicto with a common barnyard fowl."
Vimes listened open-mouthed as the pink, well-scrubbed face talked about the gentle, fragrant landscape, as if it was populated by devils from the most invidious pit. He unrolled a crime sheet that badly needed the laundry. No major murders, just nastiness, silliness, and all the crimes of human ignorance and stupidity. Of course, where there were people, there was crime. It just seemed out of place in the slow world of big spaces and singing birds. And yet, he'd smelled it as soon as he was here, and now he was in the middle of it.
"You get a tingle," said Feeny. "That's what my dad told me. He said, watch, listen, and keep your eye on every man. There never was a good policeman who didn't have a slice of villain somewhere in him, and this will call to you. It will say, this man has something to hide, or this man is far more frightened than he should be, or this man is acting too cocky by half because underneath he's a bag of nerves. It will call to you."
Vimes opted for admiration rather than shock, but not too much admiration.
"Well, Mr. Feeny, I reckon your grandfather and your dad got it right. So I'm sending the right signals, am I?"
"No, sir, none at all, sir. My granddad and my dad could go like that sometimes, totally blank. It makes people nervous."
Feeny cocked his head on one side and said, "Just a moment, sir, I think we have a little problem."
The door to the lock-up clanged open as Chief Constable Upshot skidded around to the rear of the squat little building. Something yelped and squealed, and then Vimes, sitting peacefully inside, suddenly had goblins on his lap. In fact, it was only one goblin, but one goblin is more than sufficient at close quarters. There was the smell to begin with, and not to end with either, because it appeared to permeate the world. Yet it wasn't the stink, although heavens knew that they stank with all the stinks an organic creature could generate. No, anyone who walked the streets of Ankh-Morpork was more or less immune to stinks, and indeed there was now a flourishing, if that was the word, hobby of stink collecting. It was all a mystery to Vimes, who was absolutely sure that it was impossible to tell the difference between a chicken fart and a turkey fart, but there were those who professed to be able to do so, and he was glad that such people had chosen this outlet for their puzzling inclinations rather than, for example, fill their sink with human skulls collected in the High Street. And Dave, of Dave's Pin and Stamp Emporium, was extending the sign over his shop again. You couldn't bottle, or whatever it was the collectors did, the intrinsic smell of a goblin, because it wasn't so much a stink as a sensation,
the sensation, in fact, that your dental enamel was evaporating and any armour you might have was rusting at some speed. Vimes punched at the thing, but it hung on with arms and legs together, screaming in what was theoretically a voice that sounded like a bag of walnuts being jumped on. And yet it wasn't attacking unless you considered the biological warfare. It clung with its legs and waved its arms, and Vimes just managed to stop Feeny braining it with his official truncheon, because once you paid attention, the goblin was using words. And the words were, ice, ice, we want just ice, demand, demand just ice, right, just ice. Feeny, on the other hand, was shouting, stinky you little devil, I told you what I'd do to you if ever I saw you stealing the pig's will again. He looked at Vimes as if for support. They can give you horrible diseases, sir. Will you stop dancing around with that damn weapon, boy? Vimes looked down at the goblin, now struggling in his grasp, and said, as for you, you little bugger, stop your racket. The little room went silent, apart from the dying strains of, they eat their own babies, from Feeny, and, just ice, from the goblin, simply and accurately named as Stinky. Not panicking now, the goblin pointed a claw at Vimes's left wrist, looked him in the face, and said, just ice! It was a plea. The claw tugged at his leg. Just ice! The creature hobbled to the door and looked up at the glowering chief constable, and then turned to Vimes with an expression that bored into the man's face, and said, very deliberately, just ice, Mr. Policeman! Vimes pulled out his snuff box. You could say this for the brown stuff. All that ceremony you went through before you took a pinch gave you rather more thinking time than lighting a cigar. It also got people's attention. He said, well now, Chief Constable, here is somebody asking you for justice. What are you going to do about it? Feeny looked uncertain and took refuge in a certainty. It's a stinking goblin. Do you often see them around the lockup? Said Vimes, keeping his tone mild. Only Stinky, said Feeny, glaring at the goblin, who stuck out his worm-like tongue. He's always hanging around. The rest of them know what happens if they're caught thieving around here. Vimes glanced down at the goblin and recognised a badly set broken leg when he saw one. He turned the snuff-box over and over in his hands and did not look at the young man. But surely a policeman wonders what has happened for a wretched thing like this to walk right up to the law and risk being maimed again. It was a leap in the dark, but hell, he had leapt so often that the dark was a trampoline. His arm itched. He tried to ignore it, but just for a moment there was a dripping cave in front of him, and no other thought except of terrible, endless vengeance. He blinked, and the goblin was tugging at his sleeve again, and Feeny was getting angry. I didn't do that! I didn't see it done! But you know it happens, yes? And again Vimes remembered the darkness and the thirst for vengeance, in fact vengeance itself made sapient and hungry. And the little bugger had touched him on that arm. It all came back, and he wished that it hadn't, because while all coppers must have a bit of villain in them, no copper should walk around with a piece of demon as a tattoo. Feeny had lost his anger now, because he was frightened. Bishop Scour says they're demonic and insolent creations, made as a mockery of mankind, he said. I don't know about any bishops, said Vimes, but something is going on here, and I can feel the tingle. Felt it on the day I came here, and it's tingling on my land. Listen to me, Chief Constable. When you apprehend this suspect, you should take the trouble to ask them if they did it, and if they say no, you must ask them if they can prove their innocence. Got it? You're supposed to ask. Understand? And my answers are, in order, hell no, and hell yes. The little clawed hand scratched at Vimes's shirt again. Just ice! Vimes thought. Oh, well, I thought I'd been gentle with the lad up until now. Chief Constable, something is wrong, and you know that something is wrong, and you are all alone, so you'd better enlist the help of anyone you know that can be trusted. Such as me, for example, in which case I'll be the suspect who, having been bailed on my own recognizance of one penny... And here Vimes handed a partly corroded small copper disc to the astonished Feeny, has been requested to help you with your inquiries, such as they are, and that will all be fine and dandy, and in accordance with the standard work on police procedure, which, my lad, was written by me, and you had better believe it. I'm not the law. No policeman is the law. A policeman is just a man, but when he wakes up in the morning, it is the law that is his alarm clock.
I've been nice and kind to you up until now, but did you really think I was going to be spending the night in a pig pen? Time to be a real copper, lad. Do the right thing and fudge the paperwork afterwards like I do.
Vimes looked down at the persistent little goblin.
Okay, Stinky, lead the way.
But my old mummy's just coming out with your dinner, Commander.
Feeny's voice was a wail, and Vimes hesitated. It didn't do to upset an old mum. It was time to let the Duke out. Vimes never normally bowed to anybody, but he bowed to Mistress Upshot, who almost dropped her tray in ecstatic confusion.
I am mortified, my dear Mistress Upshot, to have to ask you to keep your man-dog-suck-po warm for us for a little while, because your son here, a credit to his uniform and to his parents, has asked me to assist him in an errand of considerable importance, which can only be entrusted to a young man with integrity as your lad here.
As the woman very nearly melted in pride and happiness, Vimes pulled the young man away.
Sir, the dish was bang-suck-duck. We only have man-dog-suck-po on Sundays, with mashed carrots.
Vimes turned back, shook Mrs. Upshot warmly by the hand, and said,
I look forward to tasting it later, my dear Mistress Upshot, but if you'll excuse me, your son is a stickler for his police work, as I'm sure you know.
Colonel Charles Augustus Makepeace had long ago, with the expertise of a lifelong strategist, decided to let Letitia have her way in all things. It saved so much trouble and left him able to potter around in his garden, take care of his dragons, and to occasionally go trout fishing, a pastime that he loved. He rented half a mile of stream, but was sadly now finding it difficult to keep running fast enough. Nowadays, he spent a lot of time in his library, working on the second volume of his memoirs, keeping from under his wife's feet and not getting involved. Until this moment, he had been quite happy that she had the role of chairman of the magistrates, because it kept her away from home for hours at a time. He had never been very much of a one for thinking in terms of good or bad, and guilty or not guilty. He had learned to think in terms of us and them, and dead and not dead. And therefore, he wasn't exactly listening to the group sitting around the long table at the other end of the library, talking in worried voices, but nevertheless he couldn't help overhearing. She had signed that damned document. He ought to have tried to talk her out of it, but he knew where that would have ended. Commander Vimes, okay, by all accounts the man was the sort to rush in, and maybe he did have a scrap with what's-his-name, the blacksmith, who wasn't too bad a cove in his way. Bit of a hothead, of course, but he'd made a damn good dragon prod only the other day at quite a reasonable price. Vimes? Not a killer, surely. That's one thing you learned in the military. You don't last long if you're a killer. Killing as duty called was another thing entirely. Letitia had listened to that unspeakable lawyer, and they had all agreed it was to be signed simply because that wretched Rust fellow wanted it. He opened this month's edition of Fang and Fire. Occasionally, somebody lowered their voice, which you couldn't help thinking was damned insulting, given that they were sitting in a chap's library, and especially when the chap hadn't been consulted. But he didn't protest. He had long ago learned not to protest, and so he kept his eyes focused on the pull-out feature on flame-retardant incubators, holding it in front of him as if to ward off evil. However, among the words he didn't hear were, "Of course, he only married her for her money, you know." That was his wife's voice. And then, "I heard she was desperate to find a husband." The curiously sharp tone of that voice identified the owner as Miss Pickings, who the Colonel couldn't help noting, as he stared grimly at a full-page advertisement for asbestos kennels, had clearly been in no hurry to find a husband herself. The Colonel was, by inclination, a live-and-let-live personality, and frankly, if a gel wanted to go around with another gel who wore shirt and tie, trains horses, and has a face like a bulldog licking vinegar off a thistle, then it was entirely their business. After all, he told himself, what about old Beefy Jackson, eh? Wore a dress every night in the mess and rather flowery aftershave for a chap, but when the call to arms came, he could fight like a bloody demon. Funny old world. He tried to find his place on the page again, but was interrupted by the very Reverend Mouser. He never could get on with padres, couldn't see the point.
I find it very suspicious that the Ramkin family have turned up here after so many years, don't you? I keep reading about Vimes in the newspaper, not the kind of person you can imagine as simply taking a holiday.
According to Gravitt, he is known as Bettinardi's terrier, said Letitia.
At the other end of the room, her husband thrust his head even deeper into his magazine so as not to snigger. Gravid. Who would call their child Gravid? No one who had ever kept dragons or fish, that was certain. Of course, there was such a thing as a dictionary, but then the old Lord Rust had never been the kind of man to open a book if he could help it. The Colonel tried to contemplate an article on the treatment of zigzag throat in older males, and the wife of his heart continued.
Well, we don't want any of Vetinari's nonsense here. Apparently, his lordship rather enjoys allowing Vimes to break wind in the halls of the mighty. Apparently, Vimes is no respecter of rank, indeed quite the reverse. And, indeed, it would seem he is prepared to ambush a decent working man.
Funny, thought the Colonel. First time I ever heard her call the smith anything other than a blasted nuisance. It seemed to him that the gossip around the table was trite, artificial, like the conversation of raw recruits on the eve of their first battle. He thought, there's a warrant out for Commander Vimes, hero of Coombe Valley. Bloody good show. Wonderful execution. Peace in our time between brother troll and brother dwarf and that sort of thing. Just the job. I've seen too much killing in my time. And now you're going to put him out of a job and a reputation, just because that greasy lad with a name like a pregnant frog has charmed you into doing so.
I understand he has a very violent nature, said,
what was his name? Bit of a bad hat, in the Colonel's opinion. Bought a big villa up near Overhang, one of Rust's cronies. Never seemed to do any work. What was his name? Ah, yes, Edgehill. Not a man that you would trust behind you, more in front of you, but they'd sworn him in even so.
And he was just a street kid and a drunkard, said Letitia. What do you think of that?
The Colonel paid careful attention to his magazine, while his unspoken thoughts said,
Sounds jolly good to me, my dear. All I got when I married you was the promise of a half share in your dad's fish and chip shop when I left the service. I never even got that.
Everybody knows that his ancestor killed a king, so I can't imagine a Vimes would jib at killing a blacksmith, said the Honourable Ambrose.
Bit of a mystery, this one. Something to do with shipping. Sent out from the city to lie low here because of something to do with a girl. And the Colonel, who spent a lot of time thinking, because he wasn't allowed much time talking, had some time ago wondered to himself how, in these modern days, you got banished from the city because of a girl. And instinct had told him that possibly it had something to do with the age of the girl. After incubating that thought for a while, the Colonel had written to his old chum, Jankers Robinson, who always knew a thing or two about this and that, and one thing and another, and was now some political waller in the palace. He had made an inquiry, as one might, of his friend, whom he had once dragged to safety over the pommel of his saddle before a Clatchian scimitar got him, and had received a little note with nothing more than, yes, indeed, under age, hushed up at great expense. And after that, the Colonel had taken great care never to shake the bastard's hand again. Blithely unaware of these thoughts of the Colonel, the Honourable Ambrose, who always seemed to be slightly bigger than his clothes, said clothes being of a fashion more suited to somebody 20 years his junior, sneered,
Frankly, I think we're doing the world a service. They say that he favours dwarfs and all kinds of low life. You might expect anything of a man like that.
Yes, you might, thought the Colonel.
And Miss Picking said, But we haven't done anything wrong, have we?
The Colonel turned a page and smoothed it down with military exactitude. He thought, Well, you all condone smuggling when the right people are doing it because they're chums, and when they aren't, they're heavily fined. You apply one law for the poor and none for the rich, my dear, because the poor are such a nuisance.
He felt eyes suddenly upon him, because marital telepathy is a terrible thing. His wife said,
It doesn't do any harm, everybody does it.
Her head swung round again as her husband turned the page, his eyes fixedly on the type as he thought, as noiselessly as his brain could contrive, and of course there was the incident a few years ago. Not good, that. Not good. Not good when little babies of any sort are taken away from mothers. Not good at all. And you all know it, and it worries you, and well, it should.
The room was silent for a moment, and then Mrs. Colonel continued, There will not be any problems. Young Lord Rust has promised me. We have rights after all.
I blame that wretched blacksmith, said Miss Pickings. He keeps bringing it back into people's memories, him and that damned writing woman.
Mrs. Colonel bridled at this.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Miss Pickings. Legally, nothing wrong has happened here.
Her head swiveled towards her husband.
Are you all right, dear? She demanded. For a moment he looked as though he wasn't, and then the colonel said, "Oh, yes, dear, right as rain, right as rain." But his thoughts continued, "You have partaken in what is, I strongly suggest, a cynical attempt to ruin the career of a very good man." "I heard you coughing." It sounded like an accusation.
"Oh, just a bit of dust or something. Dear, right as rain, right as rain."
And then he slammed his magazine onto the table. Standing up, he said, "Well, I was nothing but a subaltern, dear. One of the first things I learned was that you never give away your position by frantic firing. I think I know the type of your commander, Vimes. Young Lord Rust may be safe with his money and contacts, but I doubt very much that you all will be. Who knows what would have happened if you hadn't been so hasty? What's a bit of smuggling? You've just pulled the dragon's tail and made him angry." When his wife regained control of her tongue, she said, "How dare you, Charles?"
"Oh, quite easily, as it turns out, dear," said the colonel, smiling happily. "A bit of smuggling might be considered a peccadillo, but not when you're supposed to be upholding the law. It baffles me that none of you seems to realize that. If you have any sense, ladies and gentlemen, you'll explain that whole unfortunate goblin event to His Grace right now. After all, your chum Gravid organized it. The only little problem is that you allowed him to do it, as I recall, without so much as a murmur."
"But it was not illegal," said his wife, icily. Her husband didn't move, but in some ineffable sense he was certainly taller.
"I think things got a bit tangled, you see. You thought about things as being legal or illegal. Well, I'm just a soldier, and never was a very good one, but it's my opinion you were so worried about legal and illegal that you never stopped to think about whether it was right or wrong. And now, if you'll excuse me, I'm going down to the pub."
Automatically, his wife said, "No, dear, you know drink doesn't agree with you." The colonel was all smiles.
"This evening I intend to settle my differences with drink and make it my friend."
The rest of the magistrates looked at Mrs. Colonel, who glared at her husband.
"I'll talk to you about this later, Charles," she growled.
To her surprise, his smile did not change.
"Yes, dear, I suspect you will, but I think you'll find I won't be listening. Good evening to you all."
There was a click as the door shut behind him. There should have been a slam, but some doors never quite understand the situation. The goblin was already moving quite fast with a dot-and-carry-one gait that was deceptively speedy. Vimes was surprised to find that Feeney made heavy weather of the little jog towards, he was not surprised, Hangman's Hill. He could hear the boy wheezing slightly. Perhaps you didn't need to be all that fast to overtake a wayward pig, but you needed to be very fast indeed to catch up with a young troll blizzarded to the eyeballs with Slice, and you needed lots of stamina to overtake him and slap the cuffs on him before he came down enough to try and twist your head off. Policing was obviously very different in the country. In the country, there is always somebody watching you, he thought as they sped along. Well, there was always somebody watching you in the city, too, but that was generally in the hope that you might drop dead and they could run off with your wallet. They were never interested. But here, he thought he could feel many eyes on him. Maybe they belonged to squirrels or badgers, or whatever the damn things were that Vimes heard at night time. Gorillas, possibly. He had no idea what he was going to see, but certainly didn't expect to find the top of the hill bright with lines of rope, painted yellow. He gave it only a second's glance, however. With their backs to one of the trees, and looking very apprehensive, were three goblins. One of them stood up, thus bringing its head, and therefore its eyes, to a level in the vicinity of Vimes's groin. Not a good position to find himself. It held up a wrinkled hand and said,
"Vimes, hang!"
Vimes stared down at it and then at Feeney.
"What does he mean, hang?"
"Never been quite sure," said Feeney. "Something like, have a nice day, I think, don't mean goblin."
"Vimes," the old goblin continued, "it said be, you be policeman. It be big policeman. If policeman, then just ice. Bit just ice it be no. And when dark inside dark, dark moving. Dark must come, Vimes. Dark rises. Just ice."
Vimes had no idea of the sex of the speaker, or even its age. Dress wasn't a clue. Goblins apparently wore anything that could be tied on. Its companions were watching him unblinkingly. They had stone axes, flint, vicious stuff. But it lost its edge after a couple of blows, which was no consolation when you were bleeding from the neck. He had heard that they were berserk fighters, too. Oh, and what was the other thing people said?
Ah, yes, whatever you do, don't let them scratch you.
You want justice, do you? Justice for what?
The goblin speaker stared at him and said,
Come with me, policeman.
The words rolling out like a curse, or at least a threat. The speaker turned and began to walk solemnly down the far side of the hill. The other three goblins, including the one known to Vimes as Stinky, did not move.
Feeny whispered, This could be a trap, sir.
Vimes rolled his eyes and sneered.
You think so, do you? I thought it was probably an invitation to a magical show featuring the amazing Bonko and Doris and the collapsing unicycle brothers with Fido the cat.
What's this yellow rope all about, Mr. Upshot?
Police cordon, sir. My mum knitted it for me.
Oh, yes, I can see she's managed to work the word plice in black in there several times, too.
Yes, sir, sorry about the spelling, sir,
said Feeny, clearly spooked by the stairs. He went on,
There was blood all over the ground, sir, so I scraped some into a clean jam jar just in case.
Vimes paid that no attention, because the two goblin guards had unfolded and were standing up. Stinky beckoned Vimes to walk ahead of them. Vimes shook his head, folded his arms, and turned to Feeny.
Let me tell you what you thought, Mr. Upshot. You acted on information received, didn't you? And you heard that the blacksmith and I indulged in a bout of fisticuffs outside the pub yesterday, and that is true. No doubt you were also told that at some time later someone heard a conversation in which he arranged to meet me up at this place. Yes? Don't bother to answer. I can see it in your face. You haven't quite got the copper's deadpan yet. Has Mr. Jefferson gone missing?
Feeny gave up.
Yes, Mr. Vimes.
He didn't deserve, or perhaps he did deserve, the force with which Vimes turned on him.
You will not call me Mr. Vimes, lad. You ain't earned the right. You call me Sir or Commander, or even Your Grace, if you're dumb enough to do so, understand? I could have sent the blacksmith home walking very strangely if I'd had a mind to do so yesterday. He's a big man, but no street hero. But I let him get the steam out of his tubes and calm down without losing face. Yes, he did say he wanted to meet me up here last night. When I came up here, with a witness, there was blood on the ground, which I will warrant is goblin blood, and certainly no sign of any blacksmith. You had a bloody stupid case against me when you came up to my house, and it's still a bloody stupid case. Any questions?
Feeny looked down at his feet.
No, sir. Sorry, sir.
Good. I'm glad. Think of this as a training experience, my lad, and it won't cost you a penny. Now, these goblins seem to want us to follow them, and I intend to do so, and I also intend that you will come with me. Understood?
Vimes looked at Stinky and the two goblin guards. An axe was waved in a half-hearted sort of way, indicating that they should indeed be travelling.
They set off, and he could hear sorrowful Feeny trying to be brave, but broadcasting anxiety.
They're not going to touch us, kid. First, because if they had intended to do that, they'd have done it already. And second, they want something from me.
Feeny moved a little closer.
And what would that be, sir?
Justice, said Vimes, and I think I've a premonition about what that is going to mean.